All right. Well, hello everybody and welcome. Glad for you to venture out here. We should do a quick check now that I'm actually up front and talking. The folks online, is it just Becky that was finding it muffled?
She got it figured out.
Okay.
Everybody here, Pastor Mark, okay, online here? Yeah, thumbs up.
All right. Well, let's open in a word of prayer, and then we'll get into our study for tonight. So, Heavenly Father, I give you thanks for this evening, and Father, for all who are here with us in the building. Father, we pray also for those who might be traveling and on the roads towards us. Just pray for safety for them as they come. And Lord, we're grateful for the technology that allows us to invite others in online. And I pray, Lord, that technology would work well for us tonight, and that everybody online would be able to hear and follow along. Lord, I pray for just a sense of clarity and simplicity as we look at these things tonight, Lord, that you would give us application and truths from your word that we can apply as we strive to live in a very different world than the one we remember growing up in. And Lord, I just give you thanks for this church and for the folks that make it up, Lord. I ask your blessing on each one now in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, here we go. So I know yes, it's recording. I realized that last week was a tough study. And I think part of the reason for that is we were working through. I was working out of this book here, which is Carl Truman's "The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self." And tonight we finish him, and what ended up happening is we kind of arced up through the philosophers and then kind of stopped there because I didn't have time to finish all of it, and left you up in the toolies there, kind of going like, wow, we're somewhere in the stratosphere with all these philosophers. Tonight I hope to be a lot more practical and bring these things home with some real practical application. Books I've been looking at for this week, again, the book from last week, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl R. Truman, which is an excellent book, and then his book Strange New World, which is kind of an abridgment of this one. This one is very manageable, and if you're interested in digging a little deeper, this is a really good recommendation. I also read this week C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, which if you're used to Narnia, this is not Narnia. This is C.S. Lewis in his capacity as a literary critic at Cambridge University. And he wrote these in 1943, really about the state of education, and is very interesting, the predictive things that he saw in 1943 that have come home to roost. And then this particular book is actually not a Christian publication, but if you're out in the work world thinking of people like you, Phil, if you're teaching, if you're working in any sort of academic field, this one is very interesting. This is called Counter Woke Craft by Charles Pincourt with James Lindsay, not his real name, but really gets into some of the stuff that we're going to talk about with critical theory. And isn't a Christian book, so it isn't giving you Christian solutions, but it does kind of point you in directions to say, this is what this looks like, and this is what to look for. So it was an interesting read as well. So all of those books are here at the break or after session. If you want to come up and have a look at them, by all means, come and poke away. So, only one slide in review, and I thought this was maybe the most helpful slide we had last week. Philip Reif talking about the four ages of man, and what did it mean to be authentic and to be a true self and fully engaged in your world at different points in history in the West. So for the ancient Greeks were political man. It was to be involved in the political realm, in the polis, in the Areopagus, engaged in civic duties. This is a person who says, I'm satisfied. This is a meaningful life that I'm having. After him in the Middle Ages, we get religious man. And religious man finds his primary sense of self in his involvement with religious activities, attending mass, celebrating feast days, going on pilgrimage. He says, this is what it means for me to be authentic and to be fulfilled. And then we find economic man during the time of the Enlightenment. This is a man who finds his primary sense of purpose in being involved in the means of production, in making money, in trade. And then finally we come to the period that we're in now, psychological man. And if you were here last week, you remember we talked about the difference between psychological man, who finds his identity not in outward directed activities, but rather in an inner pursuit of happiness. So all these other people are looking out of themselves, looking at the various different aspects in their world, either politics or religious or economic, and all of a sudden psychological man is internal and he's inwardly focused. So that was a little bit from last week, and then we got into the philosophers. So here's some new material. Truman talks about three steps to establish the modern self. How did we get here? And he says, step one is that the self must be psychologized. Let me say that a different way. The self, the person, the identity of a person has got to move inward. It's got to be focused on the inward feelings, on psychology. And from Rousseau that we talked about last week, his Noble Savage, he says, the authentic self is who I am internally without any of the corrupting influences in society. Right? That's what Rousseau is saying. Society corrupts. Society, schools and churches tend to impose on people things that are inauthentic. And so to be true to yourself, to be an authentic self, you have to be who you are internally. In modern lingo, you speak your truth. And that starts way back with Rousseau 300 years ago. And the romantic poets come along and say to us around that same time, true morality is found in what is beautiful and pleasing. Therefore, what gives me pleasure is what is true. Truth is not based in facts. Truth is not based in morals. Truth is based in my own personal taste, in beauty, and in the pursuit of things that make me happy. So this is the process, the first step, and this is what the philosophers were doing. This is why we were talking about them last week. These philosophers are starting to move the world from an outward-looking world who looks at politics, religion, and economics to an inward-looking world that says all these things in society, these aren't the things that matter. It's the things that are authentic to myself. These are the things that matter to me. And so step one, the self must be psychologized. The self must turn inwards. And then the second step is that psychology must be sexualized. And for that we have to thank, not exclusively, but primarily, Sigmund Freud, who says sexual desire is at the core of what it means to be human. My sexuality is my identity. If I cannot have sexual expression, I can't be happy, and my pursuit of happiness means that I must pursue sexual fulfillment. Carl Truman says of Freud, before Freud, sex was an activity for procreation or recreation. After Freud, sex is definitive of who we are as individuals, as societies, and as a species. So this is why we're up in these philosophers. Rousseau and the Romantics and Nietzsche, they move us inward and get us thinking about the inward psychological self. Freud comes along and he sexualizes that inward psychology, those desires that are inward are sexual desires. And step three, what we're going to talk about tonight, is the final step in establishing what we see today as the modern self, is that sex must be politicized. So here's the question, and I don't expect, well, I'll let you answer. What does Marx have to do with this? Now, I want to ask you to answer that, because I know your minds are reeling with all this stuff. Because in that whole list of philosophers from last week, Rousseau and the Romantics and Nietzsche and Freud, those four, all of those are dealing with moving things internally. Darwin is kind of an outlier. He's not a philosopher at all, but Darwin comes along and he says there is no telos, there is no particular end. Man is not special. Man is not part of a special creation. Man is just a creature, just like all the other creatures. So stop looking for purpose in life. And because Darwin puts it across as a scientific principle, most of your neighbors, if you were to talk to them, have Darwin somewhere in their mind as part of their social imaginary. That's how they imagine the world to be. Most of your neighbors think, yeah, I descended from an ape somewhere back. And that affects the way that they think of the significance of what life is. But Marx is something entirely different. And Marx really comes into his own this week. So here's what we know about Marx. First wave Marxism is economic theory. Right, when Marx was writing, he's writing about economics, that the proletariat, the people, the peasants, the workers, don't have any power and are being abused by the bourgeoisie, who have got all the power, and the only way to right the ship is for the proletariat, the worker, to gain power. And so, and that requires a revolution. It could be a bloody revolution, or it could be just a social revolution, but that's where all of our trade unions come from, this trying to equalize power between the people that hold power and are oppressing the poor, whether you buy Marx or not. That's what Marx is talking about, his economic theory. That's first wave Marxism. Second wave Marxism becomes political theory, right? Most famously in the hands of the Bolsheviks, of the communist revolution. Here it's the emperor and all the wealthy landowners own all the political power, and all the serfs and peasants have nothing, and we need to have a revolution to upset the status quo so that the people have the power, and you have a communist revolution and a people's government, or so it's called. But now we come to third wave Marxism, and it moves from being an economic theory about the factory and the workers to a political theory about the emperor and the peasants, and now it becomes a social theory, and it goes all over the place. And it moves internally. It becomes about my feelings and about myself, and there are people who say, I feel that I'm being oppressed. There are people who have power and want to maintain the status quo, and we have no power, and we need to work to overturn that power. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And so what happens in this third step as sex becomes politicized? So the self becomes psychologized, psychology becomes sexualized, and sex now becomes politicized. How did this happen? It's the marriage of pseudo-Freudianism to neo-Marxism. There will be an exam at the end of tonight. Okay. So Freudianism, this is all, sex is what I need to make me happy. I have to have this. I am a sexual being who pursues sexual fulfillment as my happiness. Marx, there are those who are oppressed and there are those who hold the power. And how do these two get married? Well, here's a quote from Truman's book. The marriage of Freud and Marx was to take place at the hands of two men, Wilhelm Reich and Herbert Marcuse, respectively. These two figures are central to any understanding of the modern political discourse and also to many cultural attitudes. Okay, so you might be sitting here so far thinking, I don't know if any of this matters. But what Truman is saying, and Truman knows his stuff, he says anything going on in the political realm in Canada, anything going on in the political realm in the United States, anything going on in the political realm in Europe, has a root that goes right back to Marcuse and Reich. And you're going to see that tonight, even though you've never heard of these guys. Anybody here heard of Wilhelm Reich or Marcuse? You know, Marcuse may be a little bit better known. These guys are responsible, you know, because I've been talking all week. I'm looking over and like, wow, you know, yeah. So here's Wilhelm Reich. You know, you kind of think that maybe his mother didn't get to him before the school picture there, you know. Some of you have had a school picture come home from one of your kids and you're like, didn't you comb your hair? But this is Wilhelm Reich. Reich Reich was a disciple of Freud, knew Freud personally, studied under Freud. Freud finally kind of cut his ties with Reich because he says, you're way too radical, you're too far out there. Reich strikes a note that will be of great significance in Marxist thinking, and one might argue eventually across the political spectrum in general. Okay, and so this is it. The note that goes through all of Reich's teaching and thinking, that the traditional patriarchal family is a unit of oppression. Okay, that language, oppression, that's Marxist language. And so he says, if what you picture as a family is a mom and a dad and a bunch of kids, what you're picturing is a unit of oppression that is being maintained by the status quo, by the powers that be, in order to oppress the lower people. And what we need is a revolution that will overthrow the nuclear family so that people can have freedom. Reich, in his own words, I actually removed one word out of here, and you can ask me later if you really want to know. But it's the one that is right here in these square brackets. I just put in sexual activity because it was a little graphic. This is what Wilhelm Reich says in his book, The Sexual Revolution, which was written in 1974. He says, the free society will provide ample room and security for the gratification of natural needs. Thus, it will not only prohibit, it will not only, oh, there's a typo there, I should have put in, not prohibit a love relationship between two adolescents of opposing sex, but will give it all manner of social support. Such a society will not only prohibit, will not only not prohibit the child's sexual activity, but on the contrary, will probably conclude that any adult who hinders the development of the child's sexuality should be severely dealt with. Reich is advocating for a society that will support an unencumbered sexuality for everyone, including children. The rules and mores of society, he says, are repressive and must be cast aside in order to realize freedom. Those who seek to set up some sort of sexual morality and say, thou shalt not, or there's a limit here, those are bad people and should be dealt with accordingly. And if you go, well, that is way out there, that's never going to catch hold. Understand this, in Canada today, I as a pastor, if somebody came to me and said, I'm really struggling, I've been looking at homosexual pornography, I don't know what to do. If I were to say to them, you know, homosexuality is a sin, and you need to deal with this in such a way that you don't pursue that, according to the law, that person could take me to court and have me charged because I'm interfering with a child's sexual development. When we get to transgenderism, you'll discover in Canada right now, there are court cases for parents of 12-year-olds who have said, I'm opposed to my 12-year-old daughter becoming a boy and having all the surgeries, and the government has stepped in and said, it's none of your business and you need to butt out. So this is Reich's teaching coming into full blossom here, that anybody who interferes with a child's sexual development should be severely dealt with. I mean, the shoe is very much on the opposite foot. This is more from Reich's book, The Sexual Revolution. He argues that sexual morality needs to be demolished. The existence of strict moral principles has invariably signified that the biological and specifically the sexual needs of man were not being satisfied. Stop there, just make this clear for you. So the existence of the morality that you remember growing up with, the morality that covered most of the West, the morality that caused you to look in the 1960s and think a man and a woman who aren't married shouldn't live together, two people who aren't married probably shouldn't have children together, that morality that just felt normal, felt natural to you, he says the existence of that moral principle has signified that the biological and the sexual needs of men were not being satisfied. They were standing in the way of man being truly satisfied, man being truly authentic. He goes on to say this, every moral regulation is in itself sex-negating, and all compulsory morality is life-negating. Just understand the full weight of this. So he is saying the teaching of the church is life-negating. It's death. The social revolution, that's Marxist language again, has no more important task than finally to enable human beings to realize their full potentialities and find gratification in life. And that, if you trace that back, life he equates with sex. If every moral regulation is in itself sex-negating and all compulsory morality is life-negating, and what we want is to find gratification in life, he means what we want is to find gratification in sex. I didn't include this quote, but Reich goes on to talk about the fact that we don't need a redefinition of modesty. What we need is to ban modesty altogether. Modesty is oppressive. So this is just a little dabble in Reich, and Reich's teaching finds root in the political theories that are governing how we are preparing our students today. The shoe is very much on the other foot, where in the past we said what the children probably need is an introduction to morality and some boundaries to keep them away from sexual behaviors. We reverse that today and say what our students need is to be taught more about sex and to be kept away from morality. So we're going to step over to Marcuse here in a moment, but I've got to talk for a minute about critical theory and the Frankfurt Institute. Now, honestly, and not because you heard it from me, how many people here have heard of critical theory before? Okay, so there's a number of people who have heard of critical theory. Critical theory is probably the primary, what's the word, influence in the Canadian university today. There is not a square inch of a major Canadian university today that is not impacted with critical theory that begins with the Frankfurt Institute. The Frankfurt Institute, you don't need to know all this history, started in 1923 in Frankfurt, Germany. There have been three waves. The first wave was entirely in German thinkers. They were in Germany. They came to New York. They went to Los Angeles. Very interestingly, way, way, way back in the 1940s, they were involved in the early days of film and modern music. So their ideas kind of start to matriculate and seep out through some of that. In their second wave, which is probably their most the wave that we'll talk about most today, Marcuse and some others were very influential in the sexual revolution of the 1960s. And today, the third wave, basically every high-level university department is lousy with critical theorists. So what is critical theory? I actually went and looked this up. This is a website if you want to go look this guy up. This guy's not a Christian that I know of. He teaches at an Italian university. And I couldn't quite figure out whether he was pro or in favor of or against critical theory, but he writes the article, and it's a fairly extensive article. So, and let me just say this. So critical theory is really, really, really hard to wrap your mind around because you have just tentacles that go everywhere, and they're anti-reason, they're anti-logic, they're anti just about everything. So just trying to nail these guys is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. They just sleep out everywhere. So to talk about what critical theory is, begin with traditional theory, okay? So I'll pause for a moment just so you can like let your brain relax for a minute. So here's traditional theory. Traditional theory teaches that knowledge is discovered upon self-evident propositions or based on self-evident truths, right? I mean, so in a science class, you could say, what's this made out of? You know, I think it's made out of wood. How do we determine for certain that it's made out of wood? Well, there are some self-evident truths or propositions we can make. So normally, if you remember this from science class, you would have a hypothesis, and then you would set up some way to test your hypothesis, and you would make a number of tests upon your hypothesis to see whether your hypothesis was true or false, and in the end, you would come to a conclusion, and you would say, we conclude, therefore, based on this, that this is the way it is. He goes on and says this. If one were to defend the view according to which scientific truths should pass the test of empirical confirmation, what I can see, what I can hear, what I can smell, what I can feel, what I can taste, the things that are empirical, then one would commit oneself to the idea of an objective world, a world in which there are real, whether you want to say real truths or at least real realities, where there are things that everybody can agree on and say, yes, that's made of wood, right? One would commit oneself to the idea of an objective world. Knowledge would be simply a mirror of reality. This view is firmly rejected by critical theorists. All right, so all that stuff that you think you know, all that scientific method that you think you know, all of that objective truth that you think is out there in the world, the critical theorists say none of that exists. So just to give you an example of how far this goes, this is actually taken from the province of Ontario's proposed math curriculum last year. Now this proposal was defeated, but just barely. But I want you to hear, this is the critical theorists proposing a math curriculum in this province, and this is what they wrote. Mathematics has been used to normalize racism and marginalization of non-Eurocentric mathematical knowledges and to decolonize a decolonized anti-racist approach to mathematics education makes visible its historic roots and social constructions. Now, I mean, all those big words are evidence of critical theorists because they love the big words that just, and you go, I don't understand what most of this stuff is. And so most people, not wanting to look stupid, say, oh, okay, do whatever you want, right? But when you dig in deeper, what this was proposing is that mathematics is not an objective science, that mathematics itself has been used to foment racism and marginalization, and that we need to correct mathematics in such a way that we can decolonize mathematics and make visible its historic roots as the power of the status quo to oppress the lesser peoples or to oppress the peasant. Okay, so I just want you to kind of wrap your mind around that they're going after mathematics. This is a little bit more. Since knowledge is strictly embedded in serving human interests, it follows that it cannot be considered value neutral and objectively independent. So they would argue that the reason that you say the sky is blue is because you have heard that from somebody else. And if you go back far enough, you've probably heard it from somebody who had power and influence, and they're trying to get you to believe certain things, and you need to question whether the sky is blue. Not only that, you have been observing the sky with your eyes. And who's to say that the eye is the way to determine what color the sky is? Why not the ear? Why not the tongue? Okay, if this sounds crazy, it is a little bit crazy, but the primary goal of the critical theorist is to destabilize everything in order to bring forth social revolution. So if you haven't heard of critical theory, my guess is you may have heard of some of these other ones. And here's the challenge I give you. If you think, boy, the pastor is out to lunch today, this stuff, he's making this up. Take out your phones later on and Google some of these words that are going to come up here. And what you will discover is that every major university in Canada is offering courses on these very subjects. So four different types of critical theory, and this is only a sampling of the critical theory. So you've heard of critical race theory. Okay, critical race theory, the white man is the oppressor who uses his privilege to oppress people of color, and a revolution is needed to overthrow that. We'll talk a little bit more about that revolution. Now, let me just say this, and we'll talk about this a little bit at the end, and we'll talk about this more in depth as we get into these particular subjects. Racism is an issue, and racism is an issue that the church should be concerned about and the church should deal with. I think it is dangerous when the church decides to adopt Marxist thinking, which is anti-Christian, to deal with that thing, with that way of thinking. So I'm not saying there's no racism. I'm just saying this is critical race theory that says all people of color are oppressed by all white people, even if you say, no, I don't oppress anybody, that's your privilege speaking. Critical queer theory, look this one up. You can take courses on critical queer theory, which teaches that the cisgender is oppressing all queer people and a revolution is needed. And when we get to transgenderism, we'll talk about that language of cisgender and transgender and what that means. Critical feminist theory. This goes beyond first and second wave feminism. First wave feminism is, you know, women should be allowed to vote, men vote. Women should be allowed to have a driver's license. Women should be allowed to own property. This is not that. This is critical feminist theory, which is that men are dominating women and are using their power to oppress women constantly, and a revolution is needed to overthrow this. Critical political theory, conservatives are using power to dominate all other ideologies, a revolution is needed. When we get to question period, ask me about conservatism and liberalism, because we should dig into that, but I don't want to dig into it right now, because too often, I'll say this much just to whet your appetite on it. Too often the church aligns itself lockstep with all things conservative, and I don't think Jesus would necessarily align with all things conservative. There are certain areas where I think we need to break from conservative political ideology in order to be more true to who we ought to be as Christians. But anyways... So here's the other big thinker. Some people say his name Marcuse, and some people say Marcuse. Marcuse is the way Americans say it. Marcuse is the way British people say it. I'm a Canadian. I'm descended from the British people. I say it Marcuse. So Marcuse is one of the foremost thinkers of the Frankfurt School, where critical theory came out of, and had an enormous influence in the sexual revolution beginning in the late 1960s. So here are some of the things Marcuse has written. In his work Eros and Civilization from 1966, he writes, "Taboos and the concept of perversions are means by which the bourgeoisie demonizes any type of sexual behavior that threatens their control. And behavior deemed by bourgeoisie society to be perverted or deviant is therefore, by inference, actually part of the subversive protest against the status quo. Sex focused on procreation and family is a repressive weapon of the bourgeois capitalist society, and free love and untrammeled sexual experimentation are a central place of the revolutionary liberation of society." So what you're getting here is, as Marcuse is saying, and this teaching takes hold in the 1960s especially, is a revolution is needed to destabilize and break apart the status quo who holds power, and the way to do that is sexual experimentation and a free expression of sexuality. So the entire sexual revolution, which has taken such a hold that you can't watch a television show on any major network today that is not filled with sexual experimentation, this is the revolution that has intentionally been designed to upset the status quo and to destroy the morality of earlier generations. Here's another one. This one's very interesting. I didn't want to give you the whole quote. So to summarize, he's talking here about the use of undemocratic means to open paths for subversion and culture. I'll read this to you and then I'll tell you what it means, okay? So he says this. These undemocratic means, they would include the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements which promote aggressive policies, armament, chauvinism, discrimination on the grounds of race and religion, on which or which oppose the extension of public services, social security, medical care, etc. Moreover, the restoration of freedoms of thought may necessitate new and rigid restrictions on teaching and practices in the educational institutions, which by their very methods and concepts serve to enclose the mind within the established universe of discourse and behavior, thereby precluding a prior rational evaluation of the alternatives. That's a lot of words and a lot of big words. Basically, what he is saying is that the only way that this revolution is going to be able to unseat the status quo and throw out all of this morality, which is so repressive, is we're going to have to use some undemocratic means. So, for example, free speech, which we would think of as free speech is a good thing, they say free speech has got to go. You know, you cannot have free speech and you cannot have freedom to assemble. And if you think this is way out there, check your universities. Because the common thing today at universities is to protest a speaker who's coming to speak on any subject that is not part of the approved agenda of the critical theorist. So if I was invited to speak on this topic at a university, there would be a protest to say this guy is not permitted to speak. Because if he speaks, he will bring forth this status quo, and that is an abuse of these oppressed people, and the oppressed people must be liberated. We need a revolution. So freedom of speech has to go. And the other thing he's talking about, he says tolerance is the tool of the bourgeoisie to say, well, we tolerate people. And he says that's not full acceptance. We will only be satisfied with full acceptance. This explains why, and if you watch television, you maybe notice this. Now, every brand that wants to sell something to you has to have a same-sex couple in their commercial. Because it's not enough to tolerate it, you have to embrace it. Until you've embraced it, it hasn't been accepted, and they will be satisfied with nothing less than full embracing. Every company must celebrate. It's not Gay Pride Week, it's Gay Pride Month. You know, to check out your banking website when June comes around, and all of a sudden you've got rainbow flags, and it's not the Noahic covenant that they're talking about. Every company must celebrate, and if you will not put up the flag, and especially if you're a major company, there have been major cases in the United States, not legal cases, but simply on social media of people decrying such and such a company and say, this company won't put the gay flag on their company logo during the month of June. We should all boycott this company. And the company's going like, we sell tractors, you know? And they're like, we don't care, you know, boycott John Deere. I'm not saying John Deere did it. I'm just saying that's how it works. Every politician must be made to march in the Gay Pride Parade. It's not enough to say you can have a Gay Pride Parade. The mayor has to march. If the mayor doesn't march, the mayor is canceled. If you want to know cancel culture, where that comes from, all coming out of this critical theory, wokeness, all coming out of this critical theory. Full recognition must be granted, which means that no minister may refuse to perform a same-sex marriage. No cake baker refused to make a cake for a same-sex marriage. No church refused to ordain a woman or a homosexual. No school suggests that it is wrong for a teacher born as a man to appear as a woman with enormous breasts. That if you go, why in the world is that an issue out there in Oakville and Mississauga? This is how deeply critical theory has taken hold. That for you to actually stand up and say, this is ludicrous, this is insane, this is madness, is to invite the abuse of the powers that be to come down on you with full force, which is why the school in Oakville goes, well, we don't know what to do. So here's Carl Truman commenting on Marcuse, and he's really, so he says, the goal is to transform society politically. Or if the goal is to transform society politically, then one must transform society sexually and psychologically. Where once oppression was seen in terms of economic realities, because there is such a thing as oppression and the oppressed, And so economic realities, there were people who were impoverished or who lacked property, and people who had the power to perhaps help them in that. Or legal categories, slavery or lack of freedom. Now the matter is more subtle because it relates to issues of psychology and self-consciousness. I am a man trapped in a woman's body, or I am a woman trapped in the body of a man, and you don't dare say you have a psychological condition and we need to get you some help. Rather, the answer is you must help me by giving me some sort of surgery, some sort of medication to solve my problem, because it's not the external reality that is real, it's the internal reality that has authority, and for me to be authentic, I must be who I am. So here's Carl Truman's concluding thoughts, and then I'll give you I want to give you a little bit of my concluding thoughts too. So, and this is very interesting. Carl Truman says this. He says, seek to understand. Study and examine the positions held by others in culture. This is very similar. If you remember when we talked about Charles Taylor, and Charles Taylor said there was, you could have a spin or a take. And he says, you're better to have a take than to have a spin. The spin says, everybody who thinks differently than me, these people are just stupid. They're uneducated. They don't know what's going on. They're animals. And he says, that's the spin. You just basically shut the door on everybody else and you say, I don't want to listen to it. I don't want to talk to them. I don't want to know them. Or the take is, I have a take on how these things are. You have a take on how these things are. Truman comes in on that and he says, you're better to have the take and to begin by saying, I need to understand. And he goes on, this is really important. This is a good quote. He says, careers are made in Christian circles through adopting stances on matters such as race and sexuality that ignore proper historical analysis for frameworks built on a simple zero-sum game operating with binary categories of power and impotence. In such a context, each and every opponent is simply an irrational hate monger seeking to present as a natural position that which is simply a personal preference. So let me say what this is. It is easy in Christian circles and outside Christian circles for me to create a YouTube channel where all I do is rant against the LGBTQ. Or about Black Lives Matter, or about you name whatever it is, and say, I'm opposed to it, it's wrong, and just this is what he means by a zero sum game operating with binary categories. So, to say, to take for example, and we'll get to there when we talk about racial ethics, to take for example, Black Lives Matter, that movement which ripped things, and I mean, you had major sports players refusing to stand for anthems. You had riots in streets. You had marches. And if this is a zero-sum game with binary categories of power, then that means everything about Black Lives Matter is just wrong and needs to be rejected. None of that at all it has any sort of value. He would argue instead that we need to seek to understand, study and examine positions held by others in culture so that we can understand where they're coming from, why they're coming, and what both the issues are and what the potential solutions are. And if it's not a zero-sum game, it means that there might be a few areas in the whole Black Lives Matter thing where you go, you know, we might have an issue with how you're approaching this, but we see the difficulty, or we see the problem that's been presented here, and we need to work towards a solution. I don't, you can ask me questions about this later on. I'll put this back up, but because I know we're kind of flying along here. Rather than being a person who is seeking to present as a natural position that which is simply a personal preference, and sometimes that happens in the church, that I present as something which is part of natural law, something which is in fact just a personal preference of mine. And this one I think was good too. I just gave you a couple of his. The routine use of sarcasm and insult in polemic arguments may not be a monopoly of the present age. Martin Luther used a lot of sarcasm and insult when he wrote tracts against the Pope. And the Catholics used a lot of insults and sarcasm when they wrote about Martin Luther. We're not the first generation to write a bunch of stuff. I mean, they didn't have social media. They had to print it on paper and distribute it. And Martin Luther, half the time he comes back the next week and says, I shouldn't have said that. I wish I hadn't printed it. I'm sorry everybody got a copy. I shouldn't have said that the Pope was a donkey. You know, these sorts of things. It's not the monopoly of the present age, but given that such is now profoundly associated with the deeper culture of iconoclasm and cynicism than in the past, we might do well as Christians to think critically about how frequently we resort to it. I've said this before in sermons, I say this again tonight. You may not like our Prime Minister. I'll go so far as to say this. I am no fan of our current Prime Minister. Okay, I have my reasons for not being, and in a democracy, that's not undemocratic for me to say that. But for me to resort to sarcasm and insult when it comes to our Prime Minister, to making up names for our Prime Minister, to flying flags with profanity on them about our Prime Minister, I don't think that belongs in the Christian world at all. I think that's inappropriate for a Christian. I think that brings dishonor and disrepute upon the gospel. We need to find other ways. And that's not to say that we just give a green light to everything our Prime Minister says and say, well, I'm with him. I'm not with him. I'm opposed to many, many things he says, but understand there's a difference between using insult and sarcasm and my standing and saying there are good reasons why I stand opposed to this particular idea or this particular person's governance right now. So here, finally, are four actions for the church. And I promised you some, this is where the rubber meets the road, a little bit of application tonight. These are Truman's actions, and I think they're good actions. He says, first of all, the church must reflect on how taste has trumped truth in our own midst. Okay? He says, this is the rise and triumph of the modern self. One of the things that has caused this modern self to emerge, this secular self, is it's not truth that matters, it's not morality that matters, it's what I find beautiful, what I find lovely, what I like. And he says, the church is not immune from this. We too have done this. You'll see this in worship wars, where churches have gone to war with each other on whether we sing new songs that are played on guitars or old songs that are played on organs. And he says, a lot of that argument is based not on truth, but on taste. Right? We often give higher authority to people's personal testimonies than we do to received truth. Last week, Pastor Mark, who was here with us, I think maybe he's watching online. Yeah, hi Mark. Asked the question, why has this whole LGBTQ agenda had so much traction in our churches? And in most of the churches where it's had traction, it's because the church has allowed taste to trump truth. They have listened to stories and people have come up and said, you know, I was really hurt and I was really wounded when I came to the church, and the church said you can't be in leadership and practice this way, and how hurtful that is, because this is the way I've always been all my life, and I really love Jesus, and I really love men, and I really wish that the church could get their mind wrapped around the fact that I'm not, I'm not a sinful person, I'm just different from you. And when we allow taste to trump truth, we're going to fall for that all the time. Here's the other thing he says, we've replaced, and this one might come home, you go, well, we're not doing this, right? But we've replaced ideas with images. What's the last serious book you've read? I'm not talking about a novel, I won't name it, because I'll end up naming somebody who's, when's the last time you read a serious book? Seriously, when is the last time you said, you know what, I'm going to sit down and read a book and learn something about something? How much time do you spend on TV and the internet compared to how much time do you spend reading? He says, this is part of the church allowing taste to trump truth. We have become people who have moved towards the way this culture is, and we say, well, this is my preference. I choose to go to this church rather than this church, not based on truth things, but because their pews are more comfortable, because their music is nicer, because their minister is better looking and preaches topical sermons. All right, that's his first thing. His second thing, he says the church must return to being a deeply connected community. I summarize this in this way. For many years, people have attended church rather than being the church. Right, this was long a concern for me here at Walsh Baptist Church. I thought, if tomorrow I slip on the ice, smack my head, and I'm in a coma from which I never awake, and so I will never preach here again, how many people that are here at Walsh continue to be part of this congregation at Walsh? How many people simply come because they're taste is drawn, and I mean, there's right things about going, we want sound theology, but are you connected to the church, or are you just attending the church? This has been, I think, very much improved by some of the fellowship we've had afterwards, where people, and it's not, I'm not saying, listen, if you eat sugary stuff and drink caffeinated beverage, you will be a better church, but if you spend time with the people, if you develop relationships with the people, if you begin to be concerned about one another, if you begin to form deep community, and this is what he says, the church, if we're going to survive this culture that we're living in, because this culture is not going away, we need to form deep community, because moral consciousness is formed in deep community, both in adults and in children. You will be influenced not by a church that you attend and you just sort of catch the sermons, but by a church that you're deeply involved in, that you're deeply committed to. We need no more lone rangers who are like, well, I just go from church to church to church. Get involved and become deeply committed to a community. That's his second thing. His third, the church needs to recover an understanding of natural law and a high view of the body. So natural law includes things like gravity, right? That's full of coffee, I won't drop it, or tea, but we know this. If I drop something, it goes down. That's natural law. But there are many other natural laws which are not recognized by many people in the world today. And it's not that by recovering a view of natural law, we're going to persuade the militant followers of critical theory who are trying to destabilize everything and reject all truth and reality in the universe. But rather, it's necessary to demonstrate to our own people the basis of the moral principles we adhere to. So are there natural laws that apply to sexuality? Absolutely. A natural law says that a man and a woman who are sexually involved with one another, if nature follows its natural course, are going to conceive a child, and the child is going to be born. That's natural law. And so when we talk about morals and say there are right ways to live and good ways to live and wholesome ways to live, that is based both in biblical teaching, but also in natural laws that you can observe in the universe, where there are natural reasons why homosexuality is forbidden by God. There are spiritual reasons as well, but there are natural reasons that the world would like you to forget, because they say, every sexual issue that comes along is a medical issue, not a moral issue. What happens if you have multiple sexual partners? And nature takes its course, you're going to deal with all sorts of disease. You're going to deal with all sorts of transmission. You may deal with AIDS, especially if you get into the homosexual community. And they say, that's not a moral issue. They get very angry if you say that's a moral issue. They say it's a medical issue, and our doctors need to work to come up with cures so that we can continue to pursue our freedoms. But we need to better understand natural laws so that we can demonstrate to our own people the basis of the moral principles that we hold, why we hold them. And then also a high view of the body. We must hold firmly the significance of the body and how we treat it and how we use it. That's going to come in a lot of medical ethics, abortion, medical assistance in dying. There's a lot of that that until you have an understanding of natural law, how the world works, 200 years ago before we had all this medical technology, and a high view of the body, you're going to go, well, that's just your religious beliefs. But I'm going to argue it's not just my religious beliefs. It is my religious beliefs. They're based in Scripture, and Scripture is based in the natural laws that God has established when he made this world. And then fourth, he's going to say this. He says, what model can we look for? Is there a model in the past that could help us? And he says, perhaps the best model is the model of the second century church. So this is after all of the apostles have died, Paul, Peter, John, they're all gone. And the church is now existing with the converts they have made. And he says this, in the second century, the church was a marginal sect within a dominant pluralist society. She was under suspicion, not because her central dogmas were supernatural, but rather because she appeared subversive in claiming Jesus as king and was viewed as immoral in her talk of eating and drinking human flesh and blood and expressing incestuous sounding love between brothers and sisters. Now understand, the Christians in the second century didn't actually eat and drink human blood, but when they talked about the breaking of bread, what the Roman people heard is they said, I think you guys are cannibals. You're eating and drinking human blood. They weren't actually incestuous, but they called one another brother and sister. And sometimes a husband and wife, I would say, this is my sister in Christ. And they say that he's married to a sister. They weren't, but they came under great suspicion in the Roman community. The Roman community looked at them and said, you guys are weird. You guys are subversive. You guys won't bow the knee to the emperor of Rome. You believe Jesus is your king. So how did they overcome that and set the stage for great gains in future centuries? Not by overwhelming their current culture with power. The second century church had no power. They had no ability to walk into the halls of power and say, I demand a hearing. I demand my space. I demand. There was no democracy. They couldn't vote in the people they wanted. How did they do it? By existing as a close-knit, doctrinally bounded community that required her members to act consistently with their faith and to be good citizens of the earthly city as far as good citizenship was compatible with faithfulness to Christ. So Truman says, you want a model? Here's a model of people without any power, without any influence, without any ability to vote in what they wanted or demand what they wanted or insist on what they wanted, without any social media access. How do they transform the world? They are close-knit as a community. They understand their doctrine and what they believe. They expect their people to live in accordance with their faith, and they expect their people to be good citizens of Rome as far as good citizenship is compatible with faithfulness to Christ. So that's Truman. Here's my final thoughts. Just a few minutes on a biblical model, and we're right within our time, coming up on a break. So, question. How were the Pharisees similar to Jesus? I'll take answers on this. Anything at all. How were the Pharisees and Jesus similar?
They taught the same truths from the Old Testament.
They both believed the Old Testament. They both taught similar or the same truths from the Old Testament, right? That's absolutely true. Did the Pharisees believe in the Ten Commandments? No. Did Jesus believe in the Ten Commandments? Okay, so this is one way they're similar. Anything else that you can think of? They both believed in resurrection from the dead. They both believed that there was a time of final judgment, that God would raise the dead. Both of them agreed on that. Okay, I think we could argue that both of them would argue that they wanted to see righteousness and purity as a mark of human society. Would you agree with that? The Pharisees wanted purity. Jesus wanted purity, right? So, how did Jesus differ from the Pharisees? Any thoughts? Nate?
The Pharisees thought that success was by filling the law. And Jesus knew that that was not possible and it was his fulfillment.
You're touching the right thing. It's, that one's a tricky one, because in some ways they both would agree that Jesus would absolutely say that the only way a person is going to be justified is by fulfilling the law.
The Pharisees went by the word of the law, and Jesus went by the spirit of the law.
Okay. There was definitely that. I mean, when it comes to things like the Sabbath, right? The Pharisees, the thing that first ignites the anger of the Pharisees is that Jesus keeps violating the Sabbath, because he keeps healing people on the Sabbath. It's, when you read the Bible, it's like Jesus went out of his way to heal people on the Sabbath. And it got the Pharisees so angry. You know, they're like, we've got a rule about this. Could you heal them on Monday? And Jesus says, you guys are interpreting that law so literally, and the reality is that is it not right to do good on the Sabbath? And I am doing good on the Sabbath, right? So yes, they interpreted things in ways, and Jesus said, you have put too much, you're too literal in some of these interpretations. Other ways that Jesus differed from the Pharisees. Monty?
He associated with people of the lower class.
Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, this is something, both want purity, both want righteousness, both want a society of people who are obedient to God. The Pharisees say, we have nothing to do with prostitutes and tax collectors. Those are vile, vile people who are under the ban by God and who deserve to be punished by God. We don't even talk to them. We would never be seen anywhere near a prostitute, lest somebody think that we go to the prostitutes. And yet Jesus, we see him all the time. He's a friend of sinners and tax collectors. Right? And so, and Jesus is one who goes to these communities. Right? Anything else that you can think of how Jesus differs from the Pharisees?
Jesus loved the people, and the Pharisees loved their laws.
Yeah. So Jesus loved the people, and the Pharisees loved purity, loved their law, but I mean, they loved purity. And I would say this, the Pharisees weaponized the Old Testament. The Pharisees weaponized the Old Testament. The Pharisees were very quick to jump on somebody and condemn them. Here's a little piece of scripture, just one selected passage from Matthew chapter 23, and picking up at verse 4. Jesus is speaking, and he says of the Pharisees, he says, they preach, but they do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others. And skip down a little further to about verse 13 or 14. He says, but woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You do not enter yourself, nor allow those who would enter to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel across sea and land to make a single proselyte. And when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as you yourselves are. The Pharisees are quick to judge, quick to close the door, quick to say, oh, you have spoiled your copybook. There's no hope for you. You're cut off. We want a pure society, and the only people that need apply are people who have never done anything really obviously wrong. And Jesus is saying, you guys seem to misunderstand that your sin, even though it's not as morally reprehensible or as morally unacceptable in society, your sin is just as significant as the sin of the prostitute and the sin as the sin of the tax collector. Here's the last question on this slide, and then I've got one other. What sort of Messiah did the Jews anticipate, and how did Jesus disappoint their expectations? Nate, sure.
They thought of the Messiah as their king, the one that would take them to be free of slavery, free of the yoke of Rome, free of all. They saw the end Messiah, not the gracious Messiah.
Right. So
Jenny wanted to say that for the last question. Sorry.
Yeah.
How did Jesus differ from the Pharisees? I just want to say that
with the Pharisees, it was an outward expression of faith, but with the Jesus, it was an inward change of heart.
Yeah, so a transformation of the heart, and very much, here, Jesus has an understanding. He even says to the Pharisees, do you not know that the prostitutes and tax collectors go into the kingdom ahead of you? And they didn't have a category for how they could get ahead, because they thought you get ahead by working really, really, really hard, and you keep all the laws, and you do everything that's right. In fact, the Pharisees, you won't find it in the Bible, but the Pharisees in their writing said, if we could get all Jews for 24 hours to keep the whole law, it would usher in the kingdom of God immediately. You know, so that's what they're aiming for. And so in order to do that, you've got to cut off everybody who isn't going to do that and say you're completely cut off. And this is important. The Jews anticipated a Messiah who was going to immediately establish the kingdom of God as a physical reality where righteousness ruled and the Romans were out. And Jesus constantly disappointed their expectations, because Jesus came and said, I have come to establish a spiritual kingdom in the hearts of men. And there is a physical kingdom coming, but not yet. Maybe you can see where I'm going with this. Questions to ask yourself. What is my motivation for engaging culture? Right, we've got this culture that is so different from the culture that we grew up in, this culture that alarms us and disturbs us and perhaps provokes anger in us. Am I motivated by hate or love? When I decide I'm going to engage this culture, when I decide I'm going to engage my neighbor, is my engagement with my neighbor motivated by love for my neighbor or by hate for my neighbor? Is my motivation for typing what I'm going to type next on social media and post into the blazing fire of opinions motivated by love or motivated by hate? Because I think that's very important. Because I think there are places where we need to engage our culture, but I think we need to do this check. Am I seeking to maintain power or to make a disciple? God's call upon us, the Great Commission, go into the world and preach the gospel to all nations, or in another place, go and make disciples of all people, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. Lo, I'm with you always to the end of the age. That's Jesus to his disciples. It's interesting, in the book of Acts, we never ever find the apostles trying to break their way into the halls of power in order to correct the abuses of Rome and change the behaviors of the Roman people by legislation. And yet, we find the Apostle Paul often before Agrippa, before Festus, before Felix, before people of power. And every time he's before the people of power, what does he aim at? He aims at their heart. He aims at their personal conversion. That's what the church is concerned with, is the conversion of the lost. And so I set this up because this is a question that keeps coming up week after week after week. How do I engage? When do I engage? What is the motivation for my engagement? It is not that I'm trying to legislate the morality of other people. It is not that I'm trying to seize power. It is not that I'm so angry at what you people are doing to this nation. It is rather my love for you, my understanding that you are an eternal soul, and my desire that you should be a genuine follower of Jesus Christ. And as we do that, if we were to go back to the slide there, the second century church, they had no power, they had no influence, they had no ability to vote in the person they wanted. They had to do it this way. They had to do it Great Commission way. And I think that's the model for us as the church. So that's the end of our slideshow, and we're going to break. We'll take 7 or 8 minutes to grab some refreshments, and then I'll invite you to come back, and we'll take any questions that you've got. So. All right, welcome back. Maybe do the typing thing just because the audio won't be very strong. So, okay, if everybody wants to just come back in and We got a number of folks online. So folks that are online, if you have questions, just go ahead and either direct them to Jay or type to everyone if you aren't concerned about privacy, and he'll ask your questions for you. But comments or questions regarding anything we've talked about in the last 3 weeks, or any of the outworkings of that?
I think, Mark, and this is more of a comment or a question. I'm on YouTube all the time and watching different preachers and stuff. But if I'm not here, I watch you. And actually, I watch you two or three times if I don't send a sermon. But anyway, John McCarthy, I listened to one of his just not too long ago, and he said, when God abandons a nation, and the book of Romans 1, he said, it tells you exactly what's going to happen, three things. And he said, the first thing is going to be a sexual revolution. And he said, look at the late 60s, 70s, 80s. He said, that happened. And he said, the next thing that's going to happen is going to be a homosexual revolution. And he said, that's happened. And he said, the third thing that's going to happen, he said, the book says, is going to be that God is going to give a reprobate mind. And he said, look at everything that's happening right now. He said, the women that think they're men think they're women, all this. So he said, there's no turning back. He said, we've gone this far. He said, we're not going to turn it back.
Yep.
So he said, just stay focused. Basically, and that's just more of a comment and
yep.
a question with the whole.
Yeah, I'm just going to pause for 1 second. I saw you pull that plug. Do you want to? Which one is it? Not that one. Do you want to just find a plug for this, because this is hot, and I don't want the bulb to burst because it needs to have the fan running. So, and it's not running right now. So, here. There's a plug behind you there. Just plug that in. We don't need the projector right now. Sorry, the funds of country churches. Yeah. No, the computer is more important than the projector. But if we don't have the projector next week, it won't be any good. So that's really interesting. And I'm not sure if everybody online could hear that, but just the comment, John MacArthur in a sermon talking from Romans 1 about the decline, and seeing in that a mirror to the sort of things that we're seeing today. And the one thing I always want to caution people on, I don't think John MacArthur falls into this with that comment, but I do bump into this every once in a while, is the danger of equating, and it happens more often with America than Canada, the danger of equating America with Israel. And I see that every once in a while. God established a covenant with the people of Israel, and the entire nation of Israel was in covenant with God under the old covenant. No such covenant exists with America. There is not any special blessing that God has promised to America. A nation can reap particular blessings from God when that nation conducts themselves in ways that God says he will bless, but there is no place to lay claim on the promises of God from a national level. The only nation that can lay claim on the promises of God is, and this will surprise a few people, but the Christian nation. To Abraham, God said, through you I will bless all the world, and it is the Christian who has a right to lay claim to the promises of God. And even the Jew today, in this under the new covenant, the Jew, if they want the blessings that God has promised, will receive those blessings only through Christ. There's not two ways for the Jew to get their blessings. They can't go, I'm Abraham's descendant, so I get the blessing. It's no, Christ has become the fulfillment of the law. You need to go to Christ. You can't be like, well, I'm a Jew, so I don't need Jesus. But anyways, all that to say, be aware, especially when you're out there on YouTube, that there are people out there that put this idea across that America had some sort of covenant with God and has forfeited their covenant with God because of what they did. America's never had a covenant with God. Canada's never had a covenant with God. No nation other than the Israelites have ever had a covenant with God. And that kind of leads to some of our interest is less in trying to save nations and more in trying to save souls, because in saving souls, nations are changed. But a good comment. Thank you, Keith. Any other comments or questions? Inane remarks.
So, Mark, I was just thinking when you were talking about the hate parade that the leaders are expected to be in. Like, who put that expectation on them? Is it the gay community itself? Who would put the expectation on a minister to marry a gay couple? What would you do in that situation? What's your recourse?
Those expectations are coming from the culture and predominantly driven by the community that is either the gay community or the allies of the gay community. And if you've heard terms like cancel culture, there are legal ramifications that can come against certain people, and sometimes it's not legal ramifications, but it's social ramifications. So to give you an illustration, the mission that we support out in Newfoundland, last year, ran into this situation. They had posted all around downtown St. John's. They were just a brand new church plant, and they were trying to kind of get up and get started. And they were going to be doing a Bible study called Christianity Explored. It's a great study. It's a basic understanding of Christianity for people who know nothing about Christianity. It's a video series. The guy who does the video series is a sound believer and has over the years preached on various different things. Somebody in the St. John's community saw the flyer, went online, looked this guy up, traced him down, listened to a whole bunch of his sermons, found some sermons where he said some things about homosexuality that he said it was wrong, and came back to the city council and said, these people are homophobic bigots, and they shouldn't be allowed to rent space in our city. Now, there were no laws that they had broken in Canada, and there was no recourse that the government had to take the church plant pastor and put him in prison or fine him or charge him with anything. But the response of social media, so this was a social response, was a piling on. These people are bad people. These are awful people. These are people who are opposed to homosexuals. And the guy who was planting the church, he said the video series that we were going to watch doesn't even deal with the subject. But he said you had no recourse to try to correct that. He says we lost our spot. The people who were renting the spot to us, not on any legal grounds, but simply on preferential grounds, said, no, we can't have you in here. You've lost your community center is closed to you. He said we couldn't even wear our sweatshirts that said Mile One Mission downtown, because he said there were death threats that were uttered online, not only against him, but against his wife and against his little tiny children who are the size of the little kids who are here. He said CBC came in to do a story on the homophobic pastor and the homophobic church plant. So, I mean, media, education and media are the two areas that are deeply gripped by this critical theory that's made its way in. And read anything from the CBC and you're going to read stuff that's Freudian, neo-Marxist stuff. It's critical theory all over the CBC. So, and that went for months. He said the only reason CBC didn't publish the story is because of the death threats that were uttered against his wife and his children. And he said the CBC suddenly said, well, you know, CBC decides what stories to run, and they were all gung-ho to run a story against a homophobic church pastor and church plant in St. John's, but they said it makes the gay community look bad when they're uttering death threats against three-year-olds, so we better not run that story. And it wasn't because they were in favor of the church, it was just we don't want to make the gay community look bad. So that's cancel culture, where there wasn't a legal thing. So I mean, if you're the mayor and you say I won't march in the parade, there's a lot of social pressure and you know, basically the promise that you're not going to get elected. That doesn't mean that if I'm the mayor that I'm going to do it, but there is definite social consequences that come. Yeah, Dave.
A couple things there, Mark. Just on the path you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know that story well, so obviously no matter. But two things I find the most significant: one, a little bit of background on policing, so I would expect that someone within their congregation or a pastor himself or somebody would have went directly to the police with those threats of death. Because that's a serious matter.
Yep.
And if the police didn't act on it, then you can actually take action against the police. They have no option on that. So I'm kind of surprised that that action, if it wasn't taken, that should have been followed up immediately directly. But number two, I don't know the story, but I'm assuming, and maybe wrongfully assuming, that the rest of the pastors in Newfoundland, and for that matter, Canada-wide, knew about that. There should have been direct condemnation of that. And death threats being made, that should have been. And I find too often when you hear these things, what you're talking about, when it gets to that extreme, too many people are willing to say nothing in the name of, I don't want to offend, or I don't want to this, or whatever it is. But there is righteous justice, and that means when somebody's doing something wrong, Christian or not,
yeah,
we're still expected to speak up about that.
Yeah.
It's not we're supposed to stand down and pretend like, you know, everything's okay. If you're threatening a family or 3-year-olds,
yeah,
that needs to be immediately.
Yeah. And I know this pastor. I do believe that with the death threats there, that there those things were followed up and the police looked into that. That there was that kind of thing. The tricky thing for a pastor, especially a pastor who's trying to do a church plant, is. And this is, I mean, this is, I love these rabbit trails. These are great things to get on. There is, you do want, justice is a right thing and a good thing, and justice should prevail. And so if a law is broken, you know, the report should be made. It is not a help to say, well, we're just going to ignore the law. But at the same time, I know for this guy, he said for us to go out on the offensive would have done more damage to our trying to do a church plant than for what we did. Is he said we just had to kind of step back and pray a lot and say, God, we're just trying to get this church plant going. Because he said, you know, you're just, in a certain way, you can't win in that fight. And that becomes kind of a wisdom thing where you go, you know, are we going to... And he said the funny thing was, he said, I think it lasted for about 4 or 5 months. And he said, then somebody else did something to outrage the ultra-left wing, and they completely forgot about the church. And he says, and everything kind of lifted. So I agree with you. You know, there's a place for coming out and publicly supporting and saying this is wrong. But as a pastor, I know there's certain times when I think, you know, this is right, but it may in the end not bring about righteousness. It might just bring about more wickedness.
The only thing, Mark, with that is, and this is the problem that we fall down to, that is the pastor wouldn't even have to do that. The deacon board member, somebody could have went to the police and said, hey, there's been threats made. They have to follow up on it.
Yep.
It's not a question if they want to. But the problem becomes then is that old saying, we're evil to abound.
Yep.
We just need good men to do nothing.
Yep. And I'm not suggesting that you don't go to the police. I'm just saying there's a difference between going to the police and then going out and you know, trying to think of a good illustration where, you know, if my neighbor wrongs me, if my neighbor robs me, and you tell the police, but I maybe don't post all over social media, my neighbor just robbed me and he's an awful guy, because I want to reach my neighbor, so I go to him personally and work towards you know, redemptive action. Not, I ignore laws that are broken. That comes in on issues of abuse, and especially issues of abuse in the church. If there's a report of abuse, that report should go to the police, and the police are the people to handle that. It's a thorny thing of the church also wanting to come alongside the abuser and say there is no person that is unredeemable, and let us come alongside you, not because we're going to try to circumvent justice or because justice should be allowed not to have its say, but because there also has to be room for grace and mercy and a call to repent and believe this. But Nate, you had a comment or a question?
You know, like we had the Christian Revolution and way back with the Roundheads and everything else, and you saw the Church of England like change gears. We saw Martin Luther come in, and really that kind of set up a culture that created what until maybe 50 years ago, 60 years ago, was really kind of a dominant culture where it was expected that you would wait until you were married before you were having sex. It was expected that it was between a man and a woman. And these were all laws that were biblical laws, like they were our Ten Commandments. But really, weirdly, they were also our secular cultural laws. And that was because we were living in an era of passed down glory from, you know, that revolution. And I'm wondering if it's that shocking that we've finally seen that needle shifting back. I'm sure Satan's been hammering at that needle for a long time, and it's not overly surprising in my mind that he's used sexual promiscuity and immorality to be that major swing, because it's the sin of the flesh. Like any other temptation, what are you supposed to do? Stand and fight. But the temptation of the flesh, and that's, you know, it's not surprising that that's what's kind of thrown that needle over. And now you're seeing it cascade down through all these other areas, all linking in with that. And I'm just wondering if, what your thought on that is. Like reading, where was it, somewhere, if you can confuse the population enough, right, critical theory basically makes it very confusing for everything, because as soon as you think you nail them down.
Yeah, if you want to know why this generation of young people is dealing with constant anxiety and depression, it's literally because the very foundations of reality have been destroyed on purpose.
Yeah.
In order to just
use it to control them now, or not control them, but herd them easily, like your cancel culture.
Because as soon as you try to present some sort of alternate, as soon as you try to criticize critical theorists, you're a small-minded bigot, and they will move very quickly to silence you. The effect of second century Christianity upon the world was felt for a long time. The effect of Reformation Christianity upon the world was felt for a long time. But these effects take a long time to happen, you know. And I think I come back again to the question, when it comes to engaging the culture on anything, asking myself genuinely, am I motivated by hate or love in this? Am I seeking to maintain my power, or am I looking to make disciples? This is the question the second century church had to ask. And they were never tempted by the other, because they hadn't had the other. We are tempted sometimes by saying, I'm so angry at what you have done to this. I am so hate-filled. There are Christians who are very hate-filled when they see what is happening to this culture. And I would say to you, you need to be more love-filled towards your neighbor and to what's happening to your neighbor. Yeah.
As a point to that, I was, when we were talking about it, and talking about sarcastic comments and you know, things like that. Jesus in the Bible, the one that popped out when he was talking to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, he called them whitewashed tombs, which was extremely insulting to him and everything else. But I can completely believe that the reason he said that was to try and jar them out of their incorrect belief towards believing in what is correct, right? Like Jesus, anytime he argued with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, it was always to bring them to God and, yeah, and correct their way. Whereas when we have profanities about Trudeau, like, I don't, yeah, see too many people.
Jesus was never flippant.
No.
You know, and I think that's the thing. There are times when he does use maybe something that is even akin to sarcasm, but I think it's very considered, and I think it's not flippant. And I think that's the danger that the church in the 21st century has to face, is that we bring disrepute on the gospel and hinder the actual message going forward. There are a lot of discernment bloggers out there on YouTube who theologically are 98% in step with me, and in their actions and mannerisms, I'm completely opposed to how they're doing it, because I think they're not having an effect of drawing people to the gospel. They're actually having the effect of driving people away. They create a stumbling block before the stumbling block of the cross. Okay, any other questions? Gary?
I was shocked the very first time I started reading the Bible, because I get into it and I start reading, and all of a sudden the next thing I see is they're talking about, maybe not using this word, but pornography things that it carried on in them ages and that. And it, so in reality, it was around then,
oh, yeah,
as much as it is today around us.
Yeah.
So how was it dealt with then? Where did they stand in society at that time? And what, how was it dealt with? Or was it dealt with?
Right. So, I mean, in the Old Testament, under the Old Covenant, I mean, the Canaanites, God sends the Israelites to drive them out and slay them all. Right. Under the New Covenant, there's a bit of a different manner that comes in, where when Jesus encounters, say, the woman at the well, who's had five husbands and the one she's with now is not her husband, according to Levitical law, he would have reason to call for her to be stoned to death, and yet Jesus deals with her graciously and mercifully, not because he's not concerned about her behavior, and not because he doesn't want to see her living a righteous and holy life, but because he has come in order to bear the penalty for her sin, and he's got something he's able to offer her. I can give you living water. And we'll deal with some of that as we come into sexual ethics next week and over the next number of weeks. There's nothing new under the sun. Our access to pornography is very much changed today than it was in any other time. But yes, if you go back to the Roman era, the Greek era, the Canaanite era, there were great sexual perversions that are...
Even the armies, all the armies, because they were gone, yeah, away from their families for 6-8 months, a year, or whatever, right? So
So next week what we'll do, how we're going to start, and the reason we're starting, so people go, well, it's not very exciting to talk about marriage and singleness with sexual ethics, but you have to start with, this is God created sex and sexuality, and it's, there's natural laws out there that he created that are established. There is a right way to use sex and sexuality. God actually calls sex good. I mean, there's a passage in the Bible that says, delight yourself in the wife of your youth, and that part gets put on calendars and mugs, and the next verse that doesn't is, let her breasts delight you at all times, and you're like, oh, I turn red, like, what is going on? And God is like, I made it, I created it, there's a reason that you should enjoy it. I mean, Corinthians, I'm stealing next week's study, but I mean, Corinthians says, don't deprive one another, so until you understand this is what God created it for, and this is the right use, it's, if you decide once you get next week's study in your mind, the following weeks on transgenderism and homosexuality, you almost won't need those because you'll go, I understand what the right use is and why God established it that way. So, but we will get to that. Any others? We're getting a little late, but yeah, Chad.
Well, I think what you're saying was engaging the culture with more than that, and that's how we should do it. I think that's it. I was reading recently that there were like some polls came out with like younger people today that they're like more miserable and unhappier than they've ever been. And I think it comes back to this, I mean, these ideologies of sexuality and all this stuff that it breaks people down into like victim classes, right? And so your identity now is all the kids today, like it's all about like you're part of intersectional groups and like you're always a perpetual victim, right? And by constantly like looking at yourself in the mirror and like, you know, repeating the mantra of like, I'm a victim, it doesn't empower people, it actually makes them more miserable.
Right?
Because all they do is they just look around in misery and say, like, I'm a victim of this, I'm a victim of that, and because of, I'm part of this group, I'm a victim, and because I'm part of this group, I'm a victim. And I think to engage, there's a tremendous opportunity for the church to they engage the right way, say, like, engage with love and compassion,
yeah,
to really reach those people.
And just so we're clear, I am not a squidgy love guy. There are some squidgy love guys out there. There's a passage, Corinthians, I'm not sure. Love must be genuine. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. You know, and there are two sides to love, and one of the aspects of love is to, and this will come out as we get into some of this other parts of the study, is to show people that the thing that they are pursuing will not give them happiness, but will actually bring them misery. So, I mean, even what you're saying, yes, if you repeat to yourself this idea, I'm a victim, you will never, ever, ever escape that. You're always going to, you know, the gospel has better things. So understanding the person I'm dealing with and what they're going through, and sometimes that takes a little bit of time and a little conversation, but I think the other thing as Christians we need to understand is to understand the gospel and to get into that in such ways that you have got at least a fair capacity to bring that to bear on people. And don't be discouraged if you're sitting here going, well, I'm not very good at that. You know, that's not something people are usually naturally good at. That happens through continued practice, you know. I have lots of conversations I walk away from and say, that was not the conversation I wanted to have with that person, you know, and pray, God, give me an open door and help me walk through it. So, anyways. Yeah.
So, the Pastor Mark had a question for you, but he's going to suggest, for the sake of time, that maybe you reach out to him this week.
Sure.
So it's a longer answer.
Okay. Okay. Last chance. Any more? Any?
Just because you wanted us to ask. Conservatism
and liberalism. Oh, yeah, yeah. This is helpful, okay? So helpful for you to understand. The historic and traditional understanding of the term conservative and the term liberal is this, that conservatives seek to conserve. They look backwards at traditions and at history and what we have done and what we have written and who we are as a people, and they're bound to that, and so the conservative wants to conserve, and the liberal wants liberty, and there are a lot of right things about liberty. We want the church to have liberty. We want people to have liberty. We don't want people to be slaves. We want people to be free. And so the liberal, historically, the liberal looks forward and says, are there ways in which we can bring more liberty and more freedom to people? So it's interesting. Charles Spurgeon, great prince of preachers in England, was a supporter, a great supporter, an open and vocal supporter of the Liberal Party in Great Britain. And where the corruption comes in is not, and this is, I think, important for you to understand, is there if you are conservative-minded and tied to the traditions of the past, fine and good, do that in a Christian way. If you are liberal-minded and concerned with liberty and freedoms, good, and pursue that and do that Christianly. I don't want to establish a church where every single person in the church says, If you attend this church, I must be of this party. I don't care what party you're of. I'm not a member of any party, and I get myself in trouble here. I'm not opposed to you being a member, but I openly reject being a member of any political party. Because, and I'll tell you why. I will not put a sign on my lawn. I will not do it. Ever. I mean, now I've said ever. So now, who knows, you know? But here's why. Because I don't want any... I'm a pastor. I don't want a stumbling block to come before the cross. And that means I have to be able to... I have to be able to reach my neighbor. And if I've got sitting on my front lawn a sign that immediately puts up a stumbling block for a person having a meaningful conversation, that doesn't mean I don't have views and perspectives. And also that I will preach on... political subject. I have no hesitation to preach on a political subject. But these are not binary categories, as in all Christians must be conservatives. Many of the things that are involved in some of the liberal parties, the liberal party, some of the other liberal parties, are positions and things that a Christian ought not to support and cannot support. But the historic idea of being liberal in your thinking or being conservative in your thinking, there's nothing wrong with those things. And a Christian can be liberal in their thinking and have some liberal ideas as long as it's connected to that historic idea of desiring liberties and freedoms for people. Lots and lots and lots of good things there. So I've frozen the entire parking lot over, so you have to dig to get the gravel to stone me tonight on that one. I think that those are some of those things. If we shut off the projector, but where Truman kind of ended saying, too often we are. I'm look for it. What did he say? That when we build frameworks built on a zero-sum game operating binary categories of power and impotence, that kind of zero-sum game of binary power is anybody who is not a conservative and agrees with the conservative party or with a particular person in the conservative party cannot possibly be a Christian. That would be a zero-sum game of binary power and a false statement, because there are Christians who you may disagree with a lot of things, but for whatever reason they exist outside of that, and it's important for the Christian church to be able to be broad enough to understand that. And that's a longer conversation, but I wanted to lay that out there, because I didn't want to go away from this meeting and have people go, Pastor Walsh Baptist Church is definitely politically aligned in this direction. I'm not a liberal, but I want my liberty to say, you cannot lock me to a particular politician on either side of the border. I refuse to endorse any politician because I serve a higher power than any of these political powers, and I'm not going to tie God to anything there. Anyways, that's probably a good place to end. Thank you for coming. And next week we will we'll begin our study of sexual ethics with what God has to say about how they ought to be used. So I dismiss you all. Have a good night. Drive safe and watch that parking lot. It's very slippery.